duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Well, what do you know, Higher Side Chatters? Today we're celebrating a milestone of sorts with our first legitimate TV star on the podcast. No, it's not Cake Boss Buddy or Bill Nye the Science Guy, but a regular on my favorite TV show. And I'm talking about Ancient Aliens. Better yet, I'm talking about Philip Copens, goddammit. Author of 9 books with titles like 2012, Science or Fiction, Killing Kennedy, and of course, the reason for the season, the Ancient Alien Question. His resume is more diverse than the cast of Glee, and I couldn't be more excited about the next hour of my life. Philip Copens, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. I'm super psyched to have you here. Wow, man. I mean, thanks again for doing it. You know, let's start with the easy stuff. It looks like season 5 of Ancient Aliens is a go, man. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
So are people stopping you at the grocery store, breaking out new theories of the checkout line?
It hasn't gotten down to the grocery store, and I have the privilege of spending my life in various countries, the UK, France, and Los Angeles. And it has to be said that the funniest sequence of events actually happened in Las Vegas, where clearly Ancient Aliens is popular. At one point, we had breakfast in one of the hotels, and we were walking through the casino floor to get to a taxi. And one of those guys with earpieces in their ear, obviously, came up to us and said, like, sir, this is something of a strange question, but are you the guy who's on TV? So it turned out that one of the security guys was interested. And then we got into a taxi, and then when we were dropped off at our hotel, the taxi driver kind of like said, like, you're the guy from Ancient Aliens. So within 10 minutes or so, two people kind of like do it. It seems to be apparently mostly the voice, which kind of like identifies people that I'm the guy from Ancient Aliens. But it does come with a bit of street recognition because it's an extremely popular show. At the end of season 1 and 2, it was estimated that across the world, after one episode, about 100 million people had seen an episode throughout its various cycles. But that figure is really probably going to go up with 3 and 4 as that makes its way around the world, because specifically in America, season 3 was extremely popular, and the early start of season 4 was as well. So, but, you know, what I like about it is that it keeps people, or it starts people to talk and to think. And it really covers very young children to very old people who really are interested and trying to do stuff with ancient aliens. And that's great, you know, to see that you're part of something which really is kind of like bringing about, I wouldn't say a revolution in television, but definitely something which moves away from the traditional expert A says something and expert B says something completely right. The opposite. And the viewer kind of goes like, okay, so, and what about us? and that is, I think, what Ancient Aliens does. It does put the viewer central and kind of says like, okay, so here's the evidence. Now it's up to you to kind of like, you know, believe or accept that this is convincing enough or say, nah, I'm not convinced yet. And that is, you know, far more interesting from a viewer's perspective than the traditional side A says something and side B says something completely right. The opposite. It leaves viewers confused because the way side A and B is quite often talking about it is completely, you know, so diverse that no viewer can actually make up their mind at the end. But, you know, it's something which I think is a great contributing factor to the success of Ancient Aliens.
I love the show. I was so in shock first time I saw it on conventional television, you know, and I've been watching ever since. And I love the book Ancient Alien Questions, which, you know, I just finished reading. And I'll be honest, I thought it was going to be a long, detailed account of all the stone monuments and ancient sites from the show. But really, it's incredibly diverse and covers so many sides of the coin, from David Icke's reptilian agenda to the Coral Castle. It really is a great read.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, TV is obviously a visual medium, and it also is defined by the format, which is even in season one or season two, there was like 20 minutes or 30 minutes per subject. Now it's 12 minutes per subject, and 4 subjects per episode, and that's it. So we have kind of like, whenever at each year, the producers ask for kind of like, what would you like to see covered? What is kind of like, and I send in certain stuff, and quite often it comes back like, yeah, we would really like to cover this, but there is no footage of this. So for television, that's kind of a no-go zone. So obviously for a book, I'm not limited to whether there is 10 minutes of footage available of something or for something. So I was able to go into things like the Drop a Tribe in China, some other things about China for which there is no footage. Just, a few photographs, and even aspects of the Crystal Skulls can be discussed in a way that, again, you're not tied to
Right.
visual footage.
Way more in depth.
Yeah, and then obviously, I'm one of the people who appears on Ancient Aliens, but it is a TV show, and the format of the show is that really, my opinion counts as much as anybody else's, or as little as anybody else's. There are certain cases, we're being interviewed and say, what do you know about this? What do you think about this? Have you got additional evidence about this? And we're talking on camera, and kind of like, certain stuff gets retained and other things end up on the cutting floor.
Of course.
But there is no such thing as kind of like saying, what is the best evidence, or what is, or what do you think the best evidence is? Everything is treated of equal importance within those 12-minute segments. So the book allows you to kind of like create a landscape which is less flat than that, and also to go beyond it, and also to weave it in. An episode of Ancient Aliens will say, okay, this week we tackle whatever. I can kind of like go, in the book, I can make a chapter as long as I want. It's so to speak, covering 3 weeks of what did we take on television to do. So that is another liberty. And then at the final bit, I didn't want to be preaching. I wanted to present an overview and also a bit of kind of like, where are we? How is it that Eric von Däniken in 1968 posed this question? And why don't we have an answer? Why is science not to a point where we are able to answer this question? And why are, as the TV show says, ancient alien theorists not able to come up with a convincing argument? And I kind of like point out in the book as to why that is, and how it has come about, and suggest, maybe a way forward which might break a bit of this paradigm. And that there are some signs that some people in some corners of the academic world begin to realize that there might be a need for a new wave of kind of like approaching this, but it's going to take an awful long time for them to really come around to that. And so, and then also what I kind of like don't like about people in general is the fact that certain people just keep putting the burden of evidence, or the level of proof required, ever higher. Like, you can answer every question they have, but they will come up with another one just so that they don't have to accept kind of like what the topic of debate was.
Yeah, like it
Or
never
they'll,
ends.
yeah, or they'll kind of like say like, oh, well, that's all perfectly true, but what if it weren't aliens? What if they were time travelers from the future? And that's kind of like my sign-off point, always say, and that's your theory. So, kind of like, let's start debating your theory now.
Well, it's a damn fine point that you make about the tendency for skeptics to keep raising the bar for evidence. And it's funny, a little ironic, your book sort of had the opposite effect for me, in that I have been convinced, but a couple of talking points I've been using to support the theory you dismiss as essentially bullshit hoaxes. And these two points I'm referring to are the insanely popular Zachariah Sitchin translations that are apparently very inaccurate, and the fact that the man who spread the mystery of the Dogon tribe's advanced star knowledge seems to have sensationalized what they really told him. And so I've promptly removed these two arguments from my Rolodex, but let me have you tell the people why they should probably stop using these two popular talking points in their arguments as well.
Well, I mean, the Dogon thing is something which was of interest for a while. This tribe definitely is very interesting, and their star lore is extremely interesting. But basically, the basic thing is this mysterious star, which Robert Templeton identifies as Sirius B, is a star which is
Right.
invisible to the naked eye. And the Dogon make it very clear that the star is visible to the naked eye, but very difficult visible. And the very difficult visibility is because it is close to the horizon, and therefore it's very hard to see, because you've got the glare of the Earth and various other things. So that is the reason why this star is mysterious. Oh, sorry, hard to see, and Temple, who I otherwise respect, but in this case completely disagree with, basically makes it into a star which is invisible to the naked eye, and says, and then kind of says, like, well, it's invisible, so how did they see it? They must have had some form of high technology. And it's kind of like, they say that it is visible. So if you're identifying a star which is invisible, it's probably not that star. And there are other, aspects to this, but that's kind of like in a 30-second kind of like synopsis of kind of like the argument against the Dogon thing. The thing about Sitchin is that Sitchin has been something of a sleeping monster. The fact that Sitchin was wrong, the fact that Sitchin was a person who probably sort of invented an awful lot of his things, was well known within the ancient astronaut field. Whenever people were commenting or asking questions, kind of like, what do you think of Zechariah Sitchin? There was quite often kind of like silence or somebody trying to sidestep the issue. And at the same time, you have people who are absolutely convinced of what he's saying. The problem is this: there, it's twofold. One, it starts with a very simple thing. He believes, Sitchin believes, that he was able to correctly translate certain words, which, in his opinion, every other Sumerian expert had completely mistranslated. The most famous word was "mu," which he, basically said was spaceship, starship, something which would go from here into outer space. When the experts asked him, "Where do you get this from? Where, wh on what do you, on what do you base this?" He, for a period of about 30 years, remained completely silent and never deigned himself to reply to any of these people. That is not a problem. The problem is that after a while, they began to get a bit upset with this man who basically, refused. It's kind of like the guy who's constantly calling you stupid and wrong. And when you say, like, "But please tell us why we are,"
Right.
and he kind of keeps saying, "Because you're stupid and you're wrong." And it's kind of, and after a while, you kind of begin like, okay, but why?
Yeah,
And
you can't just stonewall Jackson everybody.
no, and so it came to the, and it came to the point that basically they said, okay, enough is enough. And they asked him another question. They basically said, okay, so you're telling us that we've mistranslated ancient Sumerian, but Mr. Sitchin, we know and we use a Sumerian lexicon, which is still extant. It sits on a wall, and on that wall we read in ancient Sumerian "mu," and they define this as blah blah blah. I mean, I'm not going to do the entire explanation, but basically sky or heaven. So you're actually saying, Mr. Sitchin, that the ancient Sumerians said that the word "mu" meant spaceship, but then they write on a wall that it means heaven or sky. How could you explain that difference about why the ancient Sumerians would define a word twice completely differently?
Right.
To which Sitchin, for the next 20 years, didn't say anything about. I mean, there are several examples of this, but like, really, what hit me extremely the wrong way is that I was looking for the best evidence of an ancient alien presence and or intervention in our human history. And one of the things which people have pushed forward, and Sitchin used in some of his books, was the fact that in the Sinai Desert, of in between Israel and Egypt, there are tiny glass beads where you can really see that the sand has been exposed to a very high temperature, whereby the sand turned into glass. And he, in, I think, 1989, 1990, 1991, wrote a book which basically updated some of his things. And he said, like, oh, by the way, there is this professor, or there is this scientific report now, which basically says that they have looked into these beads, and the scientific paper says that there is no known means of how these glass beads could have been created. So, as a result of that, I would say that if everything else has been taken out of the equation, the only thing which still remains is the fact that this is indeed evidence of an ancient atomic warfare. At which moment in time, I kind of thought, okay. Now, he wrote this before Google, and he hardly ever footnoted or sourced something. Now, I'm not one of those people who believes that you have to source everything, but kind of like sometimes a big claim like this, you really want to, you kind of like, you want to stir your readers to this evidence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the time of Google, really all you have to do is put in certain keywords like Sinai Desert, Egypt, glass beads, and kind of like, you know, Google starts spurting out things. And in the top 10 was a paper which actually was freely available on the internet. I downloaded it, started reading this the synopsis, and basically I realized that this was what Sitchin was talking about. Went back to the Sitchin book, saw that he had actually listed this article in his bibliography. So clearly it was the one he was referring to. And I read the synopsis and I find that Sitchin, you know, has this completely wrong. The scientific paper says the glass beads in the Sinai Desert come from a volcanic eruption. The only doubt which remained within the group of people who had done this analysis, they had even identified which volcano it was, it's Santorini. The only thing they hadn't been able to identify so far was which eruption, because within the, there were three quick, well, not quick behind each other, but relatively quick behind each other eruptions of this volcano, and they couldn't tell at that moment in time from which specific eruption of those three it had originated, which Sitchin had made into, they don't know what the origins of these glass beads are. No, the scientific paper in its synopsis clearly states a volcanic eruption, namely Terra, also known as Santorini in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, you know, there are only two possibilities here. Either Sitchin can't read and he's stupid, or he basically, you know, read it and faked his conclusion because he wanted to suit it. You know, I will give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I can't prove the second aspect, but other people are definitely, you know, as a result of the ancient alien question, I actually was asked to write a foreword for another book. And that person basically had a had another exposition of kind of like what Sitchin had been misconstruing to kind of like, you know, get to a certain point which he wanted to make. The Drogon example and Sitchin are definitely not the best evidences. The best evidences are really the little stories which hardly anybody has spoken of.
Well, I was going to say, one of my favorites is the Dropa and the stone discs. I think that's a fascinating story. There's so many weird little things about the discs. Tell us about that one.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's an amazing story. It's basically about 8 decades ago, there was an expedition into the Chinese heartland. Small beings were discovered in a cave. Next to them were stories, were discs which had inscriptions. Now, finding these discs, which are so-called bi-discs, next to people who are buried inside a cave is nothing spectacular. What was spectacular about it was that these creatures which were lying there were sort of human and weren't, in the sense that they were human, but they didn't look like you or I. They were small, their forehead was extremely thick, their joints were kind of like weird, and it was also clear that this wasn't one, but that this was a group of people. So nothing was heard for a little while, and then in 1962, there basically was a story which said that a Chinese professor had been able to identify the writing and had been able to translate it. And the translation basically said that the people who were buried there were descendants from a group of beings who had crash landed in that general vicinity several thousand years before, and that this explained why they looked so weird. And then the story was reported in a number of newspapers, including in Germany, in 1962. And then in 1970s, a guy decides to use this as material for a book, which is going to be fiction, but which he decides in his ingenuity, he will label nonfiction so that people will kind of like buy this kind of fiction. So he does it. The book, you know, kind of like sells relatively okay. By no means was a bestseller. And he then says, oh, I made it all up. It was a device which I used to kind of like, you know, lure you into my world of fiction by saying it was nonfiction. Whereby the entire community, both skeptics and various other people, said like, oh, so there's no truth to this because, you know, everything about this thing. The book was called Sun Gods in Exile. You know, it's all invented. He all invented it in 1978. It's kind of like, no, he didn't. He said that he read newspaper reports from the 1960s. And then there was an entire debate that somehow the hoax would have started in 1966. Researchers keep digging. They have now found that in 1962, as happened, this person, you know, the international media did report on it. A German researcher called Hartwig Hausdorff has found German newspapers from 1962, clearly showing that, you know, this story was in there. For a long period of time, it's kind of like people are so kind of, you know, sometimes weird. Like they see a name of a guy and they kind of like go, oh, well, this isn't, you know, this can't be a real Chinese professor because he doesn't have a Chinese name.
Dumb argument.
Have you ever heard of people from a different country?
Exactly.
In a, you know, kind of, you know, a country. And as it turns out, you know, this guy was Japanese rather than Chinese. So all of these things kind of like, you know, but basically at the core is that in the 1970s, the same discs were photographed in a museum by, I think, an Austrian tourist. And then in 1994, Hartwig Hausdorff was one of the few first tour operators who kind of like began to explore China from a perspective, from a tour point of view. And he loved all of these things. He was into it. And so he made sure that when he was in China and when he was speaking to these museums about kind of getting Westerners in there, you know, as soon as that was done, his last question of the session would be, by the way, kind of in the 1970s, I saw this thing in a book about these discs in your museum. Do you still have them? And so this is how he began to find out that the fate of these discs, they had disappeared, but that pretty much most of the story was interesting. Now, the most interesting thing is something which has happened a few years ago, which is that the Chinese authorities tried to map all the people of China, and God knows there are an awful lot of them.
Tons.
And what was happening was that in a region, there was a group of people who looked very weird, and they obviously became part of the census. And the region is pretty much, whereas these discs were found in caves in the mountains, if you were to go from that area down to the valley or the flatlands, that is like the area where these weird people were found. And these weird people looked exactly like the people who had been found on the highlands. So they realized that in the last few decades, from the 1940s, when some photographs of these were taken, the photographs are in my book, until recent times, the people, or at least some of the people, have left the highlands and are now living in the lowlands. Their features were brought to the attention of Chinese experts who tried to explain it away. They basically said that these people had been exposed to lead and that the genetic mutations were due to lead poisoning, to which other people in China basically said, but lead poisoning kills. Lead poisoning doesn't create genetic mutations. So, you know, that's where it sits. It's up to the Chinese authorities to do something there. But it sits in a very interesting place in the sense that we know that there are people who look extremely weird living in China, and they have a history of their own, which basically says that they came from the stars. Now, they might be wrong, but at least we're in a position to say, you know, these people believe that. And oh my, they look weird. They look weird.
Has anyone tried to get a DNA test on one? Like, this could be the evidence. This could be the smoking gun sitting right over there.
Absolutely. Now, you know, the position obviously is, and this is what I say in the book as well, we're at the point in time where to prove certain things, we need the active cooperation of scientists and or governments.
Right.
If I or anybody else who would try to prove or disprove this theory were to go into China, and they would say, why do you want to go and meet these people? Why do you want to, you know, have their blood, you either tell the truth or you lie. If you tell the truth and you say, well, it's because I want to find out whether they're of mixed alien origins, right now, any government, including the Chinese, will say, yeah, maybe, but not. So no authorization to do that. If you lie and you say, oh, I like these people, you know, I think they're, well, we wouldn't probably say oppressed, because if that were the case, then we probably wouldn't get in either. But kind of, you know, some kind of humanitarian thing. We want to have some DNA thing because we want to end their suffering. We want to find out why they were so mutated. At that moment in time, if you do that and you do the analysis and it comes up with the fact that they might be of mixed human extraterrestrial origin, all the scientists will say, but you went in under full pretenses, so you lied. So how do we know you're not lying about the results? So this is why...
Right, lose-lose.
It's lose-lose until they are willing to engage or are forced to engage. You know, we are in a lose-lose situation. And obviously, you know, they love saying this. Well, there is no evidence for anything to do with extraterrestrial beings right now or in the past. And it's like, no, and there's a reason why there is not, because you're not helping.
Right.
Kind of, you know, if you refuse to do any research, if you refuse to help those who are doing research, there's never going to be any evidence. And they know it, but it's a game they play.
Well, I mean, that behavior on the part of governments kind of leads me to a question. I mean, you've clearly researched the idea of the grand conspiracy, according to David Icke or William Brimley. But how much of it do you entertain as a real possibility, and what just seems like too far of a stretch? Because the way governments act, I mean, they're kind of validating Ike.
Well, I mean, you know, governments, you know, hide things on a daily basis. And most politicians, I grew up in Belgium, and I guess for sins of whoever, my ancestors, I was raised in a family of politicians, and they were all quite often from different parties, which meant that, you know, whoever was in power, kind of like some member was close to it. Anyway, at one point, a party had not been in power for about 20 years. And this meant that an entire new generation of politicians who came into power, they had never been, you know, like they were minister of this and secretary of that, and they had never been around or had these positions themselves. And all of a sudden, they were leading this country. Not this country, but Belgium. And they basically, after a few months, said, like, every day we have to cover up things for reasons which don't make sense to us. Most of it is, you know, not important, but it involves weird things in, like, you know, like, why are we covering up the fact that, and I'm making one up here, that the immigration figures or that this guy went through there? And it's like, oh, well, you know, you have to realize that it is because of this thing. And he kind of like said, like, I hate it. I hate doing this. It's not why I was elected, but it is within governments. Governments cover up, and most of the time they cover up because whenever something goes wrong and somebody from the public says, why did this go wrong? It's traced back to a person in government, and they don't want that to do. So this is primarily why cover-ups happen. Now, you know, there are other examples, and a recent one is this. In 1992, Lawrence Rockefeller decided to brief the new president, who in the end turned out to be Clinton, but when he decided to brief the new president, he had no idea who it was going to be.
Not officially.
And he asked a person, C.B. Scott Jones, to gather material which would be a good briefing document for the president. And so Clinton walks into office, and a few days, weeks later, gets presented on a kind of like, you know, private party which Rockefeller organizes, but with his briefing document, which basically says, "Dear Mr. Clinton, you are not in power. There are forces behind you who have hidden the truth of this, 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 and this, and this, and this, and this away from you," which basically disempowered him when it came to these things. You know, Carter had a different attitude. Carter basically said, like, "I'm going to find out the truth about UFOs." And he tried, you know, there were a string in the 1970s, a string of Senate hearings, congressional committees, and all of that stuff to find out about the death of Kennedy, MKUltra mind experiments. All of these things were happening in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them made progress. Some of them didn't go anywhere, or most of them didn't go anywhere near as far as where they should have gone. But they went somewhere, and evidence was uncovered that something was happening. It was just that these congressional committees and hearing things were not willing to send people to jail or things like that. They were just kind of like going, "We'll expose all of these things, and as a result of that, you know, it'll never happen again." And that was kind of like their attitude. And, you know, it's probably falls short of what they were supposed to be doing, but at least they did something. But Clinton and various people, kind of like, you know, even in the early days of the Obama administration, there were some Clintonites in there and people who were absolutely convinced that the X-Files were real. But they also believed that they were not pulling the strings, that there were forces behind them who were doing these things for them. And there is no evidence for this, but it disempowered these people. And, you know, that is a sad thing when a president thinks or is briefed by people who mean well, but actually end up doing an awful lot of damage.
Right.
You know, the briefing of a new president who's green behind his ears should not be, "Mr. President, there is a secret out there and you will never find a secret," because that president then will go like, "Okay, well, yeah. I'm glad I know." And that is the problem. And that is, you know, something which I hate about the conspiracy field in general. It disempowers you. It basically says, you can't do anything about this. Tomorrow you can go and, you know, go into Washington and you can try and change it, but it won't matter because there are forces out there. They are out there. Mm-hmm. And it's so disempowering, and it's so not true. Egypt has proven that, you know, you can bring about very quick change through, you know, a few people who are going to sit peacefully in a square. The Belgian Revolution in 1830 happened when about 500 people went to a play and said, "Enough of this Dutch dominance. We want to be free." The 250 people out of that party ran out in the streets of Brussels and said, you know, the two words, "Go away." And by morning, pretty much, Belgium was independent. During the Iraq invasion, 2 million people walked the streets of London in protest. If any of those 2 million people had decided, actually, we can occupy this London situation and Tony Blair will be no more, it would have been a revolution. But you see, right now, the people are still afraid of the people in power. And the conspiracy theorists maintain that balance. However much David Icke says, "You need to break free. You need to start doing this thing." It's like, no, you're not telling them that. You know, you're making them afraid and you're making sure that they will stay in that corner.
Yeah. I mean, those are fair points, Phil, but you could also just say we've won a few battles. Though I do agree that the conspiracy angle has a tendency to maybe quell rebellious actions because it seems pointless to go up against such a dominant enemy. There's also the problem with the savior psychology, you know, the idea that the good guys got my back. I mean, I'm being screwed, but I just have to wait it out because they're working for me on that covert power struggle against the elite behind the scenes. And man, I hope they win. And to bring this bitch back around, the same psychology can cripple the drive to study the mysteries of our origins and the ancient alien question by saying, well, I hate the global elite and they're fucking up my life, but they got the wheel and at least they know the real story. I mean, even if it's classified and hidden from the public, at least they know our history, and I'll take comfort in that. It's just a mystery to me, and a scarier realization, honestly, might be that nobody knows and that it's all been lost.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we were having this debate earlier today, and like when you have children, you know, they need to know certain things. One, that Father Christmas comes on December 25th, that there will be cereal and milk in the morning, and that you will pick them up at school at whatever time, you know, school finishes. Right. Those are kind of like the things the child needs. It needs to know certain things. The reason why so many people are religious, even though they don't really kind of like, you know, feel that religion is all that nice or that religion is kind of there, is that there is some kind of shape or form or framework for their belief system. Mm-hmm. You know, people, I mean, like, you know, I am absolutely in awe and in love with what Jesus Christ wrote, but I wouldn't call myself a Christian because I don't go to church. I was raised as a Catholic, but basically I pretty much feel abhorred by anything they do and stand for. And so am I a Christian in faith? It's kind of like, well, yeah, but I don't associate with anything of the religions. And it's because, you know, I am comfortable with the notion that Jesus Christ was an extremely interesting dude who said extremely clever things, who, you know, I want to take as an example on a daily basis and kind of go, wow, that was deep. But this kind of like, you know, this thing of like, oh, he's the son of God. And let's dogmatically hold to that because kind of like, you know, it's true, isn't it? It's kind of, we're all children of God. And there are other aspects there. And yes, you know, it's this classic thing. It's like, you know, who should we vote for, the bad guy or the worst guy? Right. And that is a sad situation to find ourselves in, but it's unfortunately the truth. And I think Europe no longer trusts politicians. They've never trusted them, and all faith in politicians went out in the early 1990s. America kept faith in politicians, lost it with George Bush for obvious reasons. But really, I find that Americans are especially hurt by, you know, Obama, yes, who basically didn't deliver. And, you know, my wife campaigned for Obama and she kind of goes like, who is this dude?
I did too. I really did too. That was the first time that I have ever really gotten involved in politics. And I already have a conspiratorial view and I can't believe I'm still kicking myself that I got played. And there's people now that I see around town that have Obama 2012 stickers on their car. And I'm like, why the hell would you put that on your car? What did he promise you 4 years ago that you were all into that came true? You know, we're still in the wars. We're in more than we were then. Guantanamo Bay is still open. The economy's shit. You know, and now we have this false choice between Obama and Romney. It's just, it's pretty ridiculous.
Well, and it comes back to the fact that he was sorely disappointed. He was a guy who was naive, walked in there, and, you know, on day one of his presidency, when he was president-elect in November, you know, I think it was 4 or 5, he had his first security briefing. And he came out of that meeting a changed man. He said words like, well, there are reasons why we can't leave Afghanistan. And it's like some guy from the civil service, you know, secretary, whoever, who had months to prepare this, who has had years of expertise in impressing politicians, and you fell for it. You fell for it. And, you know, then he kind of like, I think, you know, more recently, he just lost interest. I see a guy who basically goes like, seriously, he can't wait to get out.
I see the same thing.
And, you know, at one point it became hilarious when kind of like, you know, if somebody would like, I think it's about 2000 and the latter part of 2009 and the early part of 2010, when I swear if somebody had dropped or lost a shoe in the White House, he would have been the one doing a press conference saying, "Does this shoe belong to somebody?" For everything which was ridiculously kind of like, you know, below him, he was the guy doing the press conference. And it's kind of like, where are your secretaries? Where is everybody else in this administration? Why are you here again talking about something which really the president shouldn't be talking about? But, you know, I think that's kind of like problematic, and that kind of like, you know, kind of works into the conspiracy mindset of people saying, well, you see, you know, he was turned. It's kind of like he was part of the conspiracy. No, I absolutely do believe that Obama went in there with all the good intentions, that he was, you know, a nice man who had the best intentions. But from day one, the civil service got to him, impressed him with an awful lot of stupidity, which he fell for. Right. And then, you know, he probably realized that he fell for it, said, oh, my God, what did I just do?
Too late.
But too late.
You know, I don't take quite as optimistic a view as you do on Obama, but, you know, at least, you know, there's a funny old Bill Hicks routine that kind of ties into your newest book, but, you know, he says, you know, you get the president in there, you sit him down, you show him a view of the Kennedy assassination he's never seen, you know, you then put the curtain up and you say, you got any questions? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it works. Uri Geller has this story about how at one point, you know, certain things were happening, and Mossad showed him something whereby, I mean, you know, Uri Geller went in the 1970s around demonstrating psychic abilities, and whoever was testing him, whatever laboratory was testing him, all the tests always came out positive. And now, first of all, he hated that because he really was treated like a lab rat, kind of like, okay, I've just been tested by laboratory X, now I'm going to laboratory X. Why? Kind of like, you know, every laboratory was testing it, and it's like, it's not alive. Anyway, as a result of that, his fame began to rise. He became invited, you know, kind of, could you do this, could you do that? And there is a point whereby they really began to realize that this was dangerous, because remember, it's the early 70s. Vietnam is going on. There's massive disgruntlement. You know, politicians weren't stable in their seats, and they realized that there might be a shift into the mood thing, and Geller was a component of that, and certain people were beginning to use Geller, because guess what, Jesus comes out of India and walks on water. Well, you know, Uri Geller came out of Israel, and Uri Geller kind of like was able to bilocate, according to certain reports, and could bend spoons. So it's like that same framework.
Right.
And people were beginning to, people behind the scenes were about to set him up as kind of like, maybe he is the next Jesus. Now, he hated that, and he didn't know some of his people around him were kind of like going to do that, because they were trying to bring about change, and they felt that that was useful. So anyway, what happens is that there was a briefing whereby they basically set Uri down, and they said, you've just made the top 20 of people to be assassinated.
Wow.
You're only expected to rise if this continues. And guess what? Nobody cares whether you're alive or not, because, like Jesus, if you die, they can speculate endlessly about you. So don't think that anybody is that worried about your life. And he said, well, I am. My wife is. and they said, okay, well, there are things which we can do. We can make you controversial. We can say you don't have these powers. That'll keep you alive. And he said, yeah, I'll take that one. And then a certain guy with a long beard started to appear, who looked a bit like Father Christmas. But, you know, it's that kind of thing, you know. Things which are going on are not happening in isolation, and it influences people in power, sometimes in a good way. I've forgotten who it was, but I think it was Clinton as well. At one point, like the president publishes his reading list for over Christmas or whatever it was, and there was like a UFO book in there, and so it's interesting that people in power do realize that quite often something larger is going on,
right.
But they themselves, you know, are not necessarily the right people to come up with the answers, and it's not so much to do with the fact that the president is supposed to be all powerful. The president isn't all powerful. A dictator is all powerful. So by default, the president will never be able to answer everything, simply because he's only the president. And that has nothing to do with the conspiracy theory that there are people behind the president. We've defined the job as president as somebody who has limited power.
True. That is a fair point, man. But what about those people behind the scenes? You know, to bring it back to the book and throw out a little stone of speculation that crossed my mind a couple times while reading, you have this quote in the book, for one example, of a priest traveling with conquistadors, I think, where he casually mentions destroying all the writings and histories of the cultures they'd come across. And I started to think that that almost seems like the destruction of records was so thorough that it was one of the top priorities of the people tasked with exploring other civilizations, which sounds like a weird thing for people to do, and I'm going a little David Icke on you now, but a weird thing for people to do unless the royal bloodlines calling the shots already knew what was out there, and they wanted to make sure that any evidence or recorded accounts of aliens in the past were erased, because we might start to figure some things out, start asking some questions. I mean, what do you think? Is that a possibility?
I, you know, it's a possibility, but there's often quite very mundane reasons for it. Like in the 3rd century AD, there was a Chinese emperor who said, burn everything which comes before me. And the reason was that his ego was such that he wanted to go down into history as the start of Chinese civilization. And guess what? He got his way. Because by burning everything, the way we treat history is like, oh, well, it needs to be a written source. So by default, as nothing from before him pretty much survived, history began with this dude. So he succeeded in accomplishing what he set out to achieve. You know, not everything of contact with, if anything, I would say that most evidence of contact with non-human intelligences from our ancestors has survived. The Manetho King List, which says that the gods once ruled over ancient Egypt directly, that has survived. The Barossa's account about Oannes coming out, this half-fish, half-human creature who taught by day and went back. You know, that survived. The accounts of the Mayan kings and how they contacted the 9 gods of the underworld on a regular basis, that has survived. So there's quite a bit of survival skills to these accounts that our ancestors had, you know, contact with non-human intelligences. And again, this is kind of tying it back to kind of like the Zechariah Sitchins and the Robert Temples. I find it interesting or sad that the two of them had to come up with fake stories when there are good stories out there. And they are, you know, interesting. Like the Barossa's account does show that something was happening in that area of Iraq, and that non-human entities did have contact with human beings. Unfortunately, Sitchin prefer to invent a story rather than use a story and explore that story. And you know, the same thing with a few other examples of like, you know, Robert Temple wanted to use an African saga. Well, Egypt is an African saga. He could have used that example. So it's sad to me that people invent rather than use what is out there. You know, by no means is my book exhaustive, nor was it meant to be, nor can I be. But I think you will find, and this is kind of like what I say in the book as a generalization, kind of, you know, if ever we really go back to Africa and we sit down with these tribal elders and say like, okay, forget whoever came before, forget whatever was written about you before, could you please help us write your story? And by the way, you will have editorial control. You will be able to verify that what I write is, you know, not kind of like created to fit into a devil worship or a primitive worship or a Christian worship. Just talk. And I think if we go to these people with that attitude, then they are going to tell us a very interesting story. And also, I think in those accounts, you know, there's going to be stories about non-human intelligences. When that happened with the Hopi, you know, they began to relate as well. Again, unfortunately, and this is so sad of mankind, you know, the Hopi say one thing, then one guy jumps on it and spectacularizes it, and then he gets all the press and twists it in a way that kind of like, you know, makes it appear as if the Hopi have said that the world is going to end soon and all of that stuff. It's sad. But it's also something human, you know. Again, and it comes back to what you were talking about earlier, which is this need to have a final answer. You know, like, I'm perfectly fine living in a world where the Dogon may or may not have had contact with non-human intelligences, whether the Chinese might have had, whether we have. You know, based on all the evidence which I've seen, I think we should logically draw the conclusion: yes, we were probably contacted by non-human intelligences. Yes, we were not alone. Definitely what we can say is that our ancestors absolutely believed that they were not alone and that they had been contacted by non-human intelligences. So, you know, our ancestors might be wrong, but at least they lived within this world where they were absolutely convinced that they were not alone. Yeah. And that is, you know, to me, interesting and rich and beautiful, you know, says an awful lot, I think, about our ancestors and the world they created for themselves, and which is in, you know, marked contrast to our world, where we believe we are completely unique, completely alone, and completely special, and they believe that they were not. And as a result of that, they took care of the earth. They lived in balance with the earth, you know, and we do not, because we don't think that there's anything worthy out there which needs our, you know, our attention. A few dolphins or a few whales, you know, don't really seem to matter that much. And that is a marked difference, I think, between us and our ancestors. And, you know, there are unfortunate things to say about our world, but at the same time, I find that our world is interesting because it is being created into this viral, one global kind of, you know, connection thing. And so when our ancestors were kind of like saying how they were able to tune into the world as one, I'm kind of like feeling or seeing that maybe technology, you know, in a few years from now, seems to be able to accomplish the same thing. And I think, you know, if that happens, that might be a good thing. That might be something whereby the world kind of goes like,
well, you know, jumping off from that idea, I know you've done some work with 2012 and looking into the prophecies around that. Do you find it coincidental at all that it seems like the global economy, the very structure that we've been following since as long as we can remember, it seems to be coming apart at the seams in a lot of ways. I mean, you have the Occupy movement, which is kind of fizzled out, but I mean, that was a rebellion against capitalism. You have Iceland. You have a lot of things going in the European Union that I don't even know about. But it seems like there is a culture of people finally pointing the finger at the structure they've never pointed their finger at before, and that would be more revolutionary than anything. And it also seems to be coinciding with the time that people predicted thousands of years ago would be a period of intense change. Is that just a coincidence, or do you think those things are related?
No, I think they're absolutely related. I wouldn't say it just, you know, is limited to 2012. And the Mayans clearly say that the greatest changes happen in a period 20 years before and 20 years after these kind of milestones, and that it is really a time when things intensify. This cycle began in you know, April of 1993, and the world then and now is completely different. It's a completely different world. And that is interesting. We, you know, we are going through these rapid developments, things like Skype, the internet, being able to fly around the world pretty much on a month's salary, is something, you know, or the ability to fly around the world in 48 hours is something which 20 years ago, you know, I mean, 20 years ago, cell phones, you know, who would think that everybody's computer and internet, Wi-Fi would be on a cell thing? 20 years ago, Wi-Fi didn't exist. And all of these things really show how quickly we are moving. And there are two things here. You know, the world is coming together as a global village. Our phones get answered in India when we want to speak to our banks or wherever, and our clothing and our furniture and everything else is produced in China. It's a global village. It's a global economy. Europe tried to say, okay, we're going to do a pan-European economy as well, and we're going to make this hard, we're going to tie this into our euro and all of these things. But what they forgot was this, that there were still strong borders, that there is no such thing as a European. I have never heard anybody say to the question, where are you from? I'm from Europe. And, you know, I was born in Belgium. I live in France part-time. I live in the UK part-time. When people say to me, where are you from? My wife and I, we kind of go like, that's a good question. Have you got 5 minutes? Because it's rather complex. Yet I could say I'm a European who sometimes lives in LA. And that would answer the question. But even I, who am not necessarily kind of like tied into to a Belgian nationality or feeling specifically special for being Belgian, I don't do it, and nobody does. Yet somehow we were going to think that this euro thing was going to work, and that politicians were going to let go of their borders and were going to let go of their power. It didn't happen. It's not happening. I think it will happen eventually, but I think it's going to be a much slower process. And I think what we're seeing is basically that the entire banking issues are part of that. You know, the entire the world has become a global village, but there's nobody steering it. And meanwhile, you have a world economy who has an engine which is roaring, saying, feed me, feed me, feed me. But it's like a monster, and on occasion, like, you know, certain people feed it, like the Germans will feed it and say, here's a leaf, and the giant engine, let's give it an intelligence of its own, will kind of go like, I need much more. A leaf won't do. The Americans will put another leaf, and kind of go, okay, are you kidding me? Two leaves, I need more. And the reason why the world economy isn't working is because nobody's in charge of it. Who's left to be in charge of it are the banks.
Right. Someone's in charge.
Well, I mean, but they end up being in charge because nobody else kind of like, you know, is. And by default, the people in charge of money are, guess what? The people in charge of money, which are banks. And until we put somebody else in charge of money, you know, it's going to be like that. But there is nobody there. There is no president of the world. There is no, I mean, there's a UN, but, you know, let's laugh about it now and then and let's move on. There is nobody there. You know, the World Bank, yes, guess what? It's a bank. Once again, you know, we have created a system whereby we are not realize, well, we realize, but nobody's doing anything about it. There is a global economy. The banking industry is global, but there is no world power out there directing it. And that is a problem, which is why, you know, the banks will continuously say, well, we can't sustain this because it's not coordinated. Like, you know, the American banks can mess up as much as they want by creating completely bad mortgages and bringing everybody rest in the world down because there is no regulation. They can just do these things because, again, there is no regulation. And it's not the fault of a bank, is it? Kind of like, you know, if our children stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning and get completely drunk and do various things, the question is, well, did you ever tell them it's a bad thing? And if the answer is no, well, then you shouldn't be upset by the fact that they get drunk and stay out until 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's unfortunately right. The situation with our banks. Nobody's telling them off. Nobody's saying this is bad. And so they do whatever they want.
Well, I wonder if when the institution of, you know, fractional reserve banking was implemented, I wonder if the people who started it just created it out of happenstance, or if they had a good idea who was going to be holding all the chips at the end of the game.
Well, I mean, the sad conclusion, I think, I mean, I don't know the specific answer, but I think kind of like, you know, they, money always stays where it is. You know, it doesn't move that much. Kind of like, you know, we seem to pretend that all of these people in China and Russia are somehow new, but like, you know, they were the power brokers of the past. It's just that in the past their power and their money was run through the government accounting things, and in more recent times they just kind of like ran it through their own accounting things. Nothing truly changes, I find, there. And you know, whatever system you apply, at the end of the day, who begins with an awful lot of money at the end of the day will have just more money. And I think that's, you know, that's a game everybody plays. So that's, well, unfortunately, know, the reality.
And it just sucks, Phil, that we couldn't have got people to adopt our currency so that everyone could be indebted to us.
I believe the Americans tried to do that, and it works quite well.
Touche. Well, let me bring this back to your specialty, because we are getting down to it. And, you know, you've done a lot of research on ancient aliens and the idea that we've interacted with them and that our history may be a lot stranger than we realize, maybe older, maybe some lost civilizations we don't know about, maybe we had technology we don't know about. And it is so fun to look at these things under a microscope, case by case by case. But can you broaden it out for us? Because it gets a little hazy for me. What is the whole story? What does it look like to you? Were these interactions sporadic? Were they there at the beginning, gave us little bits of information and went away? How do we bring it together? What's the overarching story here, Phil?
I think it went something like that. We have been, and to some extent it's you know, my next book, which is coming out, is The Lost Civilization Enigma, which is coming out in October. And it's like a natural sequence to the ancient alien question. And whereas the ancient alien question asks, were we, you know, were we alone? Answering no. This is kind of like saying, were we the first? And the answer is no, we've been around for far longer. And we've been intelligent and civilized for far longer. And I think the way it went is something like this. At one point, mankind was created by, you know, whatever circumstances. At that moment in time, certain things began to happen, and people began to realize that our brain was very interesting. Maybe somebody fell from a rock once and said, like, I had this dream that I went somewhere and I saw this shiny being, and then I was back in my body. And then kind of like, you know, a few weeks later, somebody probably fell from another rock and said, like, you know, I had that same dream. And then at some point, somebody would have said, like, maybe it's not a dream. And early men definitely explored other realities. They tried to get there through, you know, creating substances to get there. They began to map the other realities and came away knowing that they were not alone, that there were intelligences, non-human intelligences out there. And then as we developed, I think we began to ask them. We began to ask them for advice, and they lent it to us. And some of these, you know, ancient alien contacts, though I say in the book that definitely some of them were physical in nature, I think also quite a few of them were non-physical in nature. And Terence McKenna is a very good example of that. He basically went into the Amazon, was given this potion, contacted his intelligence. The intelligence said, here's the nature of time, which in itself, you know, was a radically interesting thing. Even today's standards basically say that time is a byproduct of gravity and that it isn't really in existence. And whenever people kind of go like, well, time doesn't exist, it's an illusion, it's like, well, maybe it's not. And McKenna was given this thing that basically time is a fractal wave, and was given the equation and also told that in certain points in time, basically the wave of novelty would be more intense, i.e. new things would happen more often in certain pockets of time than in other pockets of time. Mm-hmm. He never really understood that. He did a bit with it, but, you know, nor was he meant to be kind of, you know, the genius who was going to figure it all out. He did his job. He gave it to the rest of us and said, like, here, I've tried to do certain stuff with it. Now maybe you would have a better chance. The difference between today and, however, the ancient Egyptians is this. Today was a lone guy who had to publish a book, who got help from, you know, 3-4 people. In doing it, one guy made it into a computer program, and that's about it. If Terence had lived in ancient Egypt, if the gods would have given, and you know, and if he would have come back from this trip, and would have said to somebody in ancient Egypt, the gods have just told me, there's not even intelligence, has just told me that time is a fractal wave, and this is the wave. It would have been a matter of state. Top geniuses in the country would have been gathered, and they would have tried to figure out what the heck this was all about. And that is the difference between our times and our history.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction for sure. Yeah, it could still be going on, and people just aren't given the time of day.
Absolutely, and you know, and I think that's really our ancestors were in contact with these non-human intelligences. They treasured it. It was something which to them was of a daily basis. They experienced the divine. You know, it wasn't like, do you believe God exists? It's like, oh, I'll give you an experience. Let's go to the temple, and you will be given an experience of another reality. And that was, you know, that was a knowing. That was wisdom rather than you know, a dude in a frock standing in front of a congregation saying trust me. You know, it's like, well, there's nothing to trust. You haven't got any direct experience of the divine. In fact, Christianity is based on a complete non-revelationary you know, kind of experience. It's basically adhering to the fact that the Catholic Church has correctly interpreted the words of Jesus, and forever shall we live in those words. It's not that much of a direct experience, and it's in stark contrast to anything which had happened before. Now, I actually don't blame the Catholic Church for, you know, being kind of like, for what that aspect of it, because it was a sign of the times. All the other religions pretty much are in that same format, and it's again something which developed over time and in our history. But the sad thing is that, you know, our ancestors, early mankind, realized that they were a part of something larger, and that seems to have trickled down to, you know, us really putting borders in, like, you know, like my community, my country, my state, when mankind as a whole can't even appreciate that they are part of our world, that we are all citizens of this world. Well, if somebody cannot define them as a citizen of the world, by default they can't identify themselves as a citizen of the universe. So by default, whoever is out there basically kind of like goes like, they don't want to hear what we have to say.
Well, I mean, cultures like the Mayans are often depicted to us as, you know, savages, but they seem to have more of that mindset, that global mindset, that we're part of the earth mindset. And you know, I wonder about the idea that people talk about, that there might be some type of energy grid under the sacred ruins that have been built around the globe. And then I think about people's obsession with astrology and the precise aligning of these structures with stars, and also the lore that you mentioned about, like, travel to realms and stuff. And I wonder if it all relates to an ability to somehow induce astral travel or an out-of-body experience with these structures on the place that they are on the earth.
It's a very good question, isn't it? Well, my the book after The Lost Civilization Enigma is actually going to go into an aspect of that, not as big as you pointed out, but like a subset of that. And the working title is actually called The Afterlife Machines of the... It's probably going to change.
Oh, that's cool.
But it does show you that certain people at certain points on this globe were... kind of like had a, you know, they showed up in a place and basically were convinced that they were going to get an otherworldly experience. And I think the short answer to your question is yes. You know, everything points out to the fact that certain places across the world allowed for access to the dimensions, and that our ancestors knew how they could manipulate these places into regulating this, like that it, you know, some places were happenstance, like the Pythia breeded fumes, but sometimes there were no fumes because they came from the earth, and sometimes the earth didn't give off these gases. They organized themselves. It was very much like, you know, soul factories, in the sense that everybody who wanted to know came to these places and would experience that they had a soul. And the factory aspect comes in, that people came and had to walk away with this experience. So they realized how they had to kind of like regulate everything so that everybody did go away with that experience, rather than just kind of like saying, well, have you got a month to hang out? And, you know, that is kind of like, I think, some of the lost technology. It was a spiritual technology, in the sense that it was technology which was meant to be, or to make us spiritual by giving us experiences. Yeah. But yes, you know, there's definitely evidence that certain places across the world have this ability innately. And then obviously when they were enhanced by our ancestors, became not necessarily even more powerful as a place of initiation, but definitely were recognized as a power of initiation. But I think as a whole, any place on earth, you know, suffices to kind of like make us go out of our mind. Certain places are just more powerful than others. Yeah. And our ancestors, you know, picked those places, obviously, where it was easier and to some extent better for them to work at than other places, because they could pick and choose where they wanted to go because there weren't any borders.
Man, there's so many questions, you know. It's a huge topic, just the ancient world and all the mysteries about the earth. But I know you got to get out of here soon. I have a couple of questions that people sent in from the internet. If we can do some quick ones.
Sure.
Before you go, Fernando asked, has there been any real outside influence on ancient aliens, or censorship, told you can't talk about a certain subject, or they might pull the plug? And do you think the government's out there, or someone's out there, throwing out disinformation to muddy these waters a little bit?
Nobody has ever tried to interfere with anything being said on ancient aliens, but as I said, there are like completely human considerations to make, like it's a TV show. So anything which isn't visible will not be aired, because there's nothing to air. It's not visual. And, you know, I don't believe in this kind of like plug being pulled on television shows. You know, it doesn't happen. It happens in very rare instances, and then everybody actually knows about it. Mostly have to do with biographies of people, whereby somebody from the family or somebody else, you know, puts an injunction in there. It sometimes happens on things to do with secrets of state, but, you know, nothing of the ancient alien thing has anything to do with that. And the UFO waters have been so muddled that our government actually loves the fact, and I actually think is actively engaged in promoting these things, because they know that the waters are so muddled that, you know, they are safe, and they don't need to use anything of that kind.
Well, you know, something we talked about earlier, which is the idea of making things up. I mean, I think that that's a built-in plus for the people who really want to muddy the waters, because the economy itself, you know, rent's got to get paid. So if you're out there doing research and you don't come up with something interesting or a narrative that makes sense and is easy to market, you might be out on the street tomorrow. So,
yeah.
You know, if on the 30th of the month you haven't found it, well, I guess it's time to start writing it.
And scientists do it as well. You know, if this report is not going to be published, then because it's basically, you know, an archaeologist who goes into a field and finds nothing, kind of like realizes that might not be the best thing for his career. And quite a few of them have gone to the cellars of museums, where they know that most of what is in these cellars is unindexed anyway. And they kind of like pretend they found it a few weeks before. That happens on a daily basis. You know, but yeah, this idea that somehow there are injunctions placed, you know, it doesn't work like that.
Well, that's good to know. And I got one more question from this Jake fella. Jake says he thinks there's an obvious correlation between aliens and what the ancients thought were gods. But do you think these beings could or did create life on Earth or even manipulate the environment to support life? And I guess you kind of talk about that in the book with the terraforming idea.
Yes. I mean, yes, I believe that DNA is intelligent, that, you know, DNA is far more interesting than we think it is. I think that DNA is universal. I don't think DNA was sent by an intelligence here. I actually think DNA is the intelligence which sends itself everywhere across the world. You know, have we been has our climate been adapted? I think no. I don't think an extraterrestrial force has adapted our climate to fit certain needs. I think it's far easier to do it the other way around, which is adapt us to our environment, or let just, you know, life be. But again, I think, you know, the history of extraterrestrial intervention in this Earth didn't begin with Homo sapiens. It began with the arrival of DNA. And that is basically what Francis Crick, who was the co-discoverer of the double helix structure of DNA, said himself. When NASA is recreating interstellar space, what they find is that the building blocks of DNA, i.e. life, are present there. It happens, it has created, the universe creates life itself. You know, and that is something which scientists are aware of, scientists know, but because it is only a decade old, isn't much out there as something which people know about, and something which, you know, kind of, you know, sure, we are considering as part of the daily debate. But, you know, I think intelligent life began when life came to planet Earth, and we are just an aspect of that. We are, you know, the final thing of on two legs, which is running around. But there are things swimming in the ocean, and there are animals out there, you know, which have a consciousness of themselves. Somebody was actually pointing out a few weeks ago, he said, like, cats never meow against each other. When cats meow, it's always for the attention of the humans. So he said, like, so how do cats communicate with each other? And it's one of those things, you know, we think we know all of these animals who are around us, but really we don't. And clearly when we began to study dolphins, it was clearly the case that we had hardly any idea whatsoever as to who they were or what was going on there. But, you know, we're an interesting species. We will hopefully move along and find some of these answers.
Well, thanks a lot for being here, man. That's pretty much all I got for you. I know you got to get going. It's been an awesome show. I had a great time talking to you. I mean, we talked a little bit about your upcoming book, and you just put out Killing Kennedy. I saw on your website you got some upcoming tours, which really look fascinating to me. The Bosnian Valley, the Pyramids, and the Inca tours. Those are exactly what I talked to somebody, Pat Chouinard, on a past show about the idea that someone needs to go and do these tours with the idea of the alternative history rather than conventional. And, I mean, I read the description, it seems exactly like what that is, and it seems awesome.
Absolutely. Again, Kathleen and I, we do these tours regularly. Bosnia and Peru is up. But like, we also take people to France, and we take people to Scotland, because we really feel that there is no substitute for traveling, for people showing them and say, like, you know, things like, you know, because the other way around, it's so weird. I mean, on a completely different note and very quickly. Like, you know, mm-hmm. Da Vinci Code somehow believed that the body of Mary Magdalene is missing. It's not. It's on display in churches, in parts. You know, one church has a head, the other one has a bone. And the church absolutely agrees with the fact that Mary Magdalene came to France after Jesus's death. But if you don't travel to these places, you will, or you're potentially convinced that Dan Brown might be right, that she's somewhere underneath the Louvre in the shopping mall. And you know, it's we want to put people into contact with the reality and say, this is what you've read about, this is what you've seen on TV. Now meet the real thing, meet the real people involved, and it becomes real. And you know, it's not just something which you've read about or seen about. The world needs to be lived, not seen on TV or read about in a book.
Great point. So you stop just being alive and start living. And philipcopens.com is the website. Phil, you got anything else to let the people know about while I still got you?
Philip Coppens, PhilipCoppens. And if you go to Twitter or Facebook and you type in my name there, you will also come to me. So you can kind of like follow me on a more daily basis if you want, and kind of like the website has articles, has information about the book, has information about tours, has basically like the central point of contact.
All right. Well, Philip Coppens, you're the man. Keep fighting the good fight. Keep doing your research. I'll keep reading about it, and hopefully I can get you on again sometime.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure, and we will meet again.
All righty, sir. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Thank you. There it is, people. There you have it. Be sure to check out the work of Philip Coppens on his website and get connected with me in the Higher Side Chats on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And stop by conspiratees.net for all your conspiracy clothing needs. The coupon code HIGHERSIDE gets you 15% off. Here's a band called The Believers Will Be Suspicious with the song The Light, appropriately about a weird light in the sky. Check them out if you like it. Boom, I'm out of here. Stuck inside and so low on supplies. Late one night I saw the light in the heart of a cold dark sky. Something strange and I cannot explain, but I know I'm never gone.
Perfume and cigarettes. I don't need shiny things to make me feel like I'm a king. What I don't spend, I Late one night I saw the light in the heart of a cold dark sky. Something strange and I cannot explain, but I know I'm never gonna be the same. Late one night I saw the light in the heart of a cold dark sky. Something strange I cannot explain, but I know I'm never gonna be the same.